image was instantly iconic. Within a couple days, it had over a million hits, to say nothing of the views that it received in newspapers across the country and around the world. My guess is that you've seen it. It's a photo of a 12-year-old Devante Hart being hugged by a Portland police officer, Sergeant Brett Barnum. One of the reasons why this photo, taken by a freelance photographer named Johnny Nguyen, why it went viral is because it was taken at a demonstration protesting police brutality. And because Sergeant Brett Barnum is white and 12-year-old Devante Hart is black. Adding to the distinctive nature of this photo is the fact that the 12-year-old Devante has tears in his eyes as he is being embraced by Barnum. And that it was published as our nation was wrestling, continues to wrestle with the effects of excessive force by police and our collective response as to how we are going to live together in this country. And yet, a hug does not make a movement. A 12-year-old hugging a police officer is not going to change the underlying assumptions that distort our judicial system. It's not going to address the root causes of systemic racism, economic, educational, cultural, and otherwise that exist in this country. It is not going to erase the distrust that exists between some in law enforcement and some in black communities. And so the danger is that in that image, it will serve to be a pacifier, right? As if by seeing this photo, we can feel better without actually having to go through the difficult but necessary changes so that all can live and breathe in a just society. So then what? What is our way forward as a nation? But what is our way forward as dual citizens, both of the United States of America and of the Kingdom of Heaven? Well, our frame from Luke's Gospel this night gives us a start. The biblical scholar Rolf Jacobson reminds us that there is a remarkable density of symbol that Luke draws upon in this, the second chapter of his account of the Gospel of Jesus the Christ. Right? The titles that we just heard the angels proclaim, they alone are stunning. "Do not be afraid," they say. "For see, I am bringing you good news of great joy for all the people. To you is born this day in the city of David a Savior who is the Messiah, the Lord." City of David, right? Messiah or Christ, the Lord. And here the same Greek word is used for the great I Am. And if this were not enough, the author of this account adds to it shepherds in the fields, which despite their earthy nature, can also be seen as royal imagery. And then, for good measure, the hosts of God in the night sky. Now, I'd imagine that for you, maybe as well as for me, these words have become so familiar to us, right? I mean, we sing them, we put them on our Christmas cards from Costco, but we don't always stop to consider them. And so, why? Why would the writer of Luke's Gospel spend so much time with these symbols? Well, in part because it tells a compelling story, but it does so with great purpose, so as to instruct the hearer. Because to those in the first generations for whom this gospel gospel was written, it was a clear signal statement of faith that this Jesus of Nazareth was who we have been waiting for. Right? Luke is saying he is the one. And so here we are, nearly 2,000 years later, dressed and possibly ready for Christmas. Right? We've surrounded ourselves with fragrant greens and flickering candlelight. I mean, we have organized our days, our weeks, almost our months, really, around this feast. And so I feel compelled to ask each of us this night, what have you been getting ready for? This was and still is a critical question for those who are attempting to be Christians in this world, for those who are trying to be followers of the Christ. And it was an essential question in the second half of the first century, as many in the Jewish communities around Jerusalem were asking themselves if this Jesus of Nazareth truly was the Messiah, the one they had been waiting for, yearning for. And it was a legitimate question, is he the one? I mean, at least one of the reasons for this question, scholars tell us, is that there were diverse understandings of what the Messiah, the Anointed One, would be like. Would he be a king like David? Right? Would he be a dread warrior, ready to rise with an army to overthrow the empire? Would he be a prophet to enact the signs of God's justice? Each of these interpretations could call upon Scripture for their claim. But Jesus did not fulfill all of them. In fact, he was not a king in the way that many expected. And so these questions remain to this day. Now, some of you may have read the book Zealot by Reza Aslan. At least my guess is that you may have heard of some of the controversy following a bizarre interview that took place on Fox News about his standing to be able to write this book as he's a practicing Muslim. To me, that question is entirely irrelevant. The more interesting question is about Aslan's interpretation of Jesus. For him, the only historical and therefore accurate interpretation of Jesus of Nazareth is that he was a bandit, a revolutionary intent on violent overthrow of the Roman and Jewish authorities. In Aslan's words, Jesus understood what every other claimant to the mantle of the Messiah did. God's sovereignty could not be established except through force. This is not a new or surprising claim, except that it just doesn't hold water. Aslan's book is well written and offers some interesting insight, but does not take into account the entirety of Jesus' actions or teachings. Instead, he interprets them through a very narrow focus, using a lens that seems to arrive in the direction that he points to from the beginning. Now, I say that this lens is not new or surprising because, well, as I hear the virulent reaction to President Obama's move to normalize relations with Cuba, right, a step encouraged, if not brokered, by Pope Francis, and as I hear the shouts, by any means necessary, at demonstration protesting police brutality, as I hear the us against them language from the leadership of several police benevolent societies, or as I hear the results of a poll that tell us that a majority of Americans this week find torture to be morally acceptable, I have returned to a most uncomfortable question. Who wants a God who becomes vulnerable? Who wants a God who becomes vulnerable? Who does? Vulnerable, like like a baby born to parents outside of their home, a baby born, like all babies, utterly dependent for food, shelter, safety. Vulnerable like a teacher who instructs his students to love and pray for their enemies. Vulnerable like a leader who tells his followers when being confronted by a mob of torches and clubs and swords, tells them to put away the sword, for those who live by the sword will die by the sword. Vulnerable like someone who gives themselves over, allowing themselves to be killed without a fight by the forces of empire that they are exposing. Are we ready for Christmas? Brené Brown, in her seminal work on the effects of shame and the power of vulnerability, has opened up for millions the third way. This way of Jesus was startling new language. Through years of research and through her own work as a social worker, she has been able to describe shame in this simple and powerful way. That shame is really easily understood as the fear of disconnection. As the fear of disconnection. Is there something about me that if other people knew it or saw it, that I won't be worthy of connection? Right? For many of us, this fear becomes so potent that we do everything we can to deny or to obscure or to hide our vulnerability. And the effects that accompany this denial of our vulnerability in this world just serve to deepen our fear and our shame. And when these feelings overwhelm us, which in this age of a 24-hour news cycle and constant connection to myriad forms of media, which threatens to swamp even the most stable ship, when these feelings overwhelm us, we react. Surrounded by what Rabbi Ed Friedman diagnosed nearly 20 years ago as a chronically anxious society, we often feel as if we have little capacity to engage or encounter that which differs from or confronts us. And so we react, sometimes through retreat, right? Attempting to remove ourselves from the people or the situations that might expose us. Other times we react through attack, blinded by our fear of what might take place, what we might lose. But whether we retreat or we attack, these reactions betray us. We only need but glance at our society to see that these reactions have left us isolated, fragmented, broken. Which is why even on this holy night, friends, I am afraid. I am afraid for the wholeness and the safety of people whom I love and for those I will never meet. To be clear, I am speaking of both black men and women, girls and boys that I hold dear, and men and women who serve as police officers who are my friends. These distorted structures that exist in this country deform and dehumanize. St. Paul would call them the powers and principalities, and they deform us all. And that is why we must together engage with one another to reform them. And so So a hug alone will not suffice. Neither will Chris Magnus standing with a sign that says Black Lives Matter. Neither will that alone be enough. But here's what may be possible. When we see actions like these, we ourselves may be able to look within and take similar actions of courage, of wholeheartedness. We may, in our own ways, be able to engage despite our fears, be able to walk in spite of our shame. For friends, we cannot remain in these places of fear or shame. I, for one, cannot live there. I love these people. I love this community. I love this country. I love this world. I love this life too much to strike out in anger founded in the fear of loss, too much to shrink back in shame, rooted in the fear of being exposed. Brené Brown offers this insight of people who are able to live from a place of vulnerability. In her research interviews, over and over again, she heard people talk about the willingness to say, "I love you," first. To do something where there are no guarantees. The willingness to breathe through waiting for the doctor to call after your mammogram. These people are willing to invest in a relationship that may or may not work out. Being vulnerable means that we are aware that we can be wounded. It means that we know that life may not go as we wish, or as we plan. It means that when we offer ourselves, we may be denied. But it means that we will choose to give, choose to hope, choose to love. So here we are. We've come again to this remembering of the birth of the Christ child, encountering yet again this mystery of all that is made finite. God embodied as we are because we are. If this night we are able to trust that we have been made in love, we have been made for love, then how will this change the way we live tomorrow? If this night we are able to trust that who we are, as we are, is enough, then how will this change the way we give ourselves to one another? If this night we are able to trust that all of life is sacred, that every human being, no matter how whole or how broken, that every human being is made in God's own image. That I am because we are. If we can trust this, then how will this change the way we act? So all that is, this kingdom of heaven,